I was looking for readings for this morning, and back when I wrote the title, I had found this reading, and it inspired me, and then I'd lost it and forgotten it. I'm at that stage in life where I realize this morning when I opened my MERS, that's man purse, that in my office, that I was actually grateful enough to make me smile that my glasses were in it. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing. But then it gives me new moments of appreciation and joy. This reading is called Mermaid, and it's from Robert Fulghum's book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, 1988. Giants, wizards, and dwarfs was the game to play. Being left in charge of about 80 children, 7 to 10 years old, while their parents were off doing parenty things, I mustered my troops in the church social hall and explained the game. It's a large-scale version of rock, paper, and scissors and involves some intellectual decision-making. But the real purpose of the game is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing people until nobody knows which side you are on or who won. Organizing a room full of wired-up grade schoolers into two teams, explaining the rudiments of the game, achieving consensus on group identity, all this is no mean accomplishment. But we did it with a right goodwill, and we were ready to go. The excitement of the chase had reached a critical mass. 80 children, 7 to 10 years old. A critical mass or mess, and I yelled out, "You have to decide now which you are, a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf." While the groups huddled in frenzied, whispered consultation, a tug came at my pants leg. A small child stands there looking up and asks in a small, concerned voice, "Where do the mermaids stand?" A long pause. A very long pause. "Where do the mermaids stand?" says I. "Yes, you see, I am a mermaid. There are no such things as mermaids. Oh, yes, I am one." She did not relate to being a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf. She knew her category, mermaid. She was not about to leave the game and go over and stand against the wall where a loser would stand. She intended to participate wherever mermaids fit into the scheme of things without giving up dignity or identity, and she took it for granted that there was a place for mermaids and that I would know just where. Well, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids. All those who are different, who do not fit the norm, and who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question, and you can build a school, a nation, or a world on it. Looking back at the back wall, and there's the portrait, Gene Huff painted portraits of ministers of this congregation, and the first was Charles Grady, and then the second is mine, and I hung them in the quiet room. But Charles' portrait was up front, and last Sunday I wasn't here, and Charles died week before last. This summer, I was in the General Assembly, and I was recognized for my 25th year in ministry, and Charles was recognized for his 50th at the same time. And he was my mentor in coming here, and then as he stayed until 6 years ago, he and Claudine lived here. He was the best. But this is not going to work real well, but I can't help myself. I talked to his daughter, Stephanie, when I was driving last weekend. I talked to her, and I said, "He was doing so well. You know, what happened?" And she said, "I don't really know. He just declined, started to decline." And she said it actually started with the election. But here's, I mean, she was serious. And she said that he just took it so hard. And here's the piece. The hospice nurse said to her, "It's the only piece of paper where I've ever written death by Trump." And I know it doesn't work, but it's just that interaction of Charles with such deep concern and where he was in his life and how somebody could care and be engaged that much. After I read Robert Fulghum's piece, Mermaid, from his book, All I Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten, I wanted to title today's reflection and put it on the sign, Where Mermaids Stand. I came close to doing it several times. We are, after all, Unitarian Universalists. Our religious understanding orients or grounds us and our values in an ultimate reality or the universe or God that is inclusive. The sun shines on all life, everyone. If God there is, God is a loving God. We are called and challenged to move into love rather than react from fear. Universalism is understood as one human family, one origin, one nature, one destiny, inclusive, no exceptions. Just as no group is out, no group can be special or privileged at the expense of others. Or as Madeleine Albright said in response to the executive order banning immigrants, there is no fine print on the Statue of Liberty. America must remain open to people of all faiths and backgrounds. In his essay, Robert Fulghum concludes by asking, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids, all those who are different, who do not fit the norm, and who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question, and you can build a school, a nation, or a world on it. But in the end, I couldn't use that title. As lovely a story as it is, upon first reading, and as catchy a title as it first appeared, and as much as I wanted to capture its simple lightness, I still do. I still share it. I still feel it. But on an obvious note, one of the problems is mermaids don't stand. And people would tell me that. And people who would read the title wouldn't have the context of the piece. This month's theme in our Soul Matters materials is identity and identities. What does it mean to be a community of identity? Or I would say a community or a congregation that takes identity seriously while accepting the spiritual discipline of doing the work to embrace diverse identities, trying to live as one human family, not merely one group. Identity is the set of characteristics by which a person is definitively recognized or known, says the definition. Our state of being, our sense of self. Psychologist Eric Erickson named the developmental stage or important work of adolescence as that of identity. And he paired it with fidelity, our role in society. When you know who you are, where do you put your heart? As adolescents, we become self-aware. We become aware of developing a self in relation to others for the first time, as seen through the eyes of others. That can actually become a paralyzing realization in adolescence. But if we can see ourselves as if through the eyes of others, that means we can also see ourselves through our own eyes. And every perspective is conditioned by a myriad of cultural and ethnic and biological and social factors and influences. The hallmark of identity, Erickson says, is a self-aware self, a self that is aware of identities and of its identities. It's aware of the each, that is in each of us. Now back to mermaids. But if you're thinking of the each in each of us, or giving it a Dr. Seuss tone, you would be thinking of the eaches in each of us. What are some of the ways you notice that might be problematic in this reading? Did anybody react to anything when I was reading it? What would be one of the things? Anybody have one? Smile? Smile. As problematic? Me smile? Or them smile? I'm not sure what you mean, Rich. I'll go with it. Anybody?
Loneliness.
What's that?
Loneliness.
Loneliness. Being alone. What are some of the identities that were not recognized? One is ableism. The game is for people who can run around. Right? Now that there's a place for mermaids, how does that change the game? Just figured out a place for the mermaid to stand. How do mermaids get to play? How do they get to play on equal terms? What are the categories that you get to choose from? Giants, wizards, dwarfs. I bet that's a Eurocentric set of categories. Sexism. Categories are heavily male. The game is heavily male. Their size and height consciousness. What if somebody is very tall or very short? How do they feel? What is the message sent to them about their identity? Are there others that you could think of?
Control.
There's a power person. That's true. That's good. Yep. Who is dictating the rules of the game and telling them what to do.
Limited choices.
Yeah. Dualistic thinking. Self and other. Right. Don.
Dress code?
Are you worried about what the mermaid would wear? Exactly. No. Well, that's it. They're mermaids, mermen, whatever. Anything else? See how you... Yeah. Andy. If you mentioned where?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. There's another question. I'll put that in the parking lot for right now. He says, how are Unitarian Universalists? But I'm actually going to speak to that a little bit, accepted in the culture. So think of that. I know it's easy to make fun of what I'm doing, you know? It's easy to say, oh, that's being politically correct. I'm not. I'm just trying to look at what are the different identities and different voices in that room. Imagine what happens when you start thinking about that and the whole focus is on getting that game organized. And then playing that game in that way, I can put myself in Robert Fulghum's position. I don't want mermaids showing up. In that moment, I don't. But once I step back, I'm so glad the mermaid was there, you know? And that's the feeling in that story. There she is. It's easy to make fun of what I'm doing. It's easy to say that's just inconvenient and be focused on the task, on getting it done. It may seem unnecessarily inconvenient and it might change the game. The game that we have done for so long, that is a tradition in our youth group This is how we play this game. But once we become aware of what it is really doing, once we notice the mermaid, how can we then argue otherwise?
Change the game.
Change the game. Exactly, that was the question. How do we change the game?
What's the objective of the game?
I don't know. It's to here it is. The objective of the game is to control 80 7 to 10-year-olds while they're having a good time. That's actually it. So that we can get on about doing something else. There you go. That's a good one.
Which group, the giants, the wizards, or the dwarves, which one attracts the most people?
I don't know. Which one attracts the most people? There you go. And are you going to allow them to vote and keep the mermaid out? See? Work with that story. That's the idea. The remedy, now that the mermaid has spoken and we've heard her, is to gather a small group, gather a community, to find what? Common unity. Some different way of doing and create change. Come together to design a new game. That's what grassroots efforts are, coming together to design a new game. The line that got my attention and my heart begins, a tug came at my pants leg, and then continues, a small child stands there looking up and asks in a small, concerned voice, where do mermaids stand? You could even focus that on why you should be working to change the game. A small child stands there looking up and asks in a small, concerned voice, where do mermaids stand? I was back to being a parent. I was back in my experience of love and care and my identity as a parent and all that meant for me. There was no question of commitment. There was no question of how I was to spend my time. There was no question of what I was going to be doing with my life. And I lived that very scene described many times. My daughter, Hannah, is now in her last semester at Chapel Hill, and her major is political science and global studies, and you'll hear some of that later on. But when she was about 2, and we were out somewhere together, maybe at the park near our house, and a stranger would approach, she would step just behind my leg, peer out, tug on my pants, look up, and ask in a small, concerned voice, do I know them? A question of identity. Some people who knew her interpreted this as shyness, and they identified her as being shy. They labeled her shy. I never did. It just seemed reasonable to check in. And when I told her yes, or they were okay, she came out. She did that when she first came here in the fellowship hall. She stepped behind my leg, said, do I know them? And then she realized she did, and then she came out. And you who saw her in fellowship hall would not say she was shy, because she checked it out. This is a long way of introducing that I asked her for references on identity. And then she gave me all these intellectual academic papers, and I said, Hannah, these are too hard to read. I can't do this. They've got lingo going on. But she introduced me to the concept of intersectionality. That's the idea that it's obvious, but there are many different identities in each of us, and you can think of them as crisscrossing or intersecting in ways that contribute to our uniqueness. It's like multiplying fractions or picking the toppings on the pizza allows, I heard Domino's say we have like 3 million different kinds of pizzas possible. It's because you just multiply all these things that crisscross and intersect. The example Hannah gave me was, I'm not just white and a small business owner concerned about regulations and taxes. My parents were immigrants, and I am the father of daughters in public schools. Or, if I am a working black woman, I live at the intersection of race, gender, and workers' rights concerns. Any one of those identities doesn't capture my experience. Some of these identities that intersect are privileged over others. From a textbook definition of intersectionality, when it comes to social inequality, people's lives and the organization of power in a given society are better understood as being shaped not by a single axis of social division, be it race or gender or class, but by many axes that work together and influence each other. Intersectionality as an analytic tool gives people a better access to the complexity of the world and of themselves. With that awareness of just how diverse we are, both within and without, comes the insight then, if we want to go that way, of how together we really are. Is the insight of our interrelatedness and interdependence. Intersectionality is a good thing, one human family. And as Joanna Macy says, that's where compassion begins, in that insight. We also very quickly see why it's so hard to bring and hold groups together, or conversely, why it's so easy to divide us up from common purpose. If everyone is focused on one of their many special interests, the larger common good is lost. It gets lost in the competition whose concern for connection only goes so far. Even as we must do the work to identify and be aware and address all these many different identities, we have to practice the connecting energies that keep us from being divided from each other, and the work of extending ourselves for an other and for an expanded sense of the common good. We must think of ourselves as coming together for all of us. That is, for the fulfillment of each of us and the each in each of us. That requires a larger vision than just the blessings of diversity. Bella Hook says it requires a commitment to both the vision and the ethic of a larger love, a larger transcendent love in which we are held and in which we participate and to which we contribute. How do we conclude our mission statement in your order of service? What's the last line? Off the top of your head. Very good, Liz. We engage in practice and service for love, justice, and peace. An ethic of love is not a vague idea. It is not an ethic of power over. It's not an ethic of domination. It's not an ethic of who wins. It honors and connects diversity and self-interest. An ethic of love asks the question, what would love do? I have a friend that I get in touch with regularly once a month for a co-counseling session, Reverend Greg Ward, and he has a format for how we do it. And the last question is just that. What would love do? Not just what is good for business. It's a different ethic. What would love do? Bella Hook says that by choosing love, we also choose to live in community. And that means we do not have to change all this by ourselves. We can count on critical affirmation and dialogue and support with all the others walking a similar path. That's why you say thank you to everyone gathered in this morning on this day. African-American theologian Howard Thurman believed that we best learn love as the practice of freedom in the context of community. And then he connected the ethic of love to the larger vision of what he thought of as the American opportunity. So it's tying it to an American, a national vision, which is smaller than the larger ethic, but it's one we respond to. Just this Friday, columnist David Brooks wrote that we are in the midst of a great war of national identity, not against radical Islam, but for, quote, the true American myth that is dynamic and universal, embracing strangers and seizing possibilities, the one that has a spiritual connection to all people in all places, the one that envisions providing people everywhere with dignity and opportunity. Then he says, not the reactionary, alien, static, and insular identity that has been injected into the national bloodstream, the one that is about building walls and staying put. He actually then calls that, he says, that is a Russian myth. That is not an American myth. But stick to what he said as a larger American vision. And he concludes with a summary of a larger vision that pulls us together. We can argue about immigration and trade and foreign policy, but nothing will be right until we restore and revive the meaning of America, that larger vision. Are we still the purpose-driven experiment Lincoln described and Emma Lazarus wrote about, assigned by Providence to spread democracy and prosperity, to welcome the stranger, to be brother and sister to the whole human race, one human family? And to look after one another, to look after one another, because we are all important in this common project? Or are we just another nation hunkered down in a fearful world? That was his concluding statement. I would add, at war with ourselves, with no larger vision, no ethic of love. I could end here. But from my notes, remember that it was Martin Luther King's leadership always framing the civil rights movement in an ethic of love that brought and held so many diverse groups together. It wasn't just that we should be doing it, or it wasn't just that people were afraid. It was he kept framing it as that was the move toward the real America, but also towards redemption and towards the way we are meant to live, held so many diverse groups together for common good and reform and change. Now let's bring it back to where we are, the scale of our lives and competence and what's going on with us. As we look for how to make a difference, know that you are making a difference. Your groups are creating community. You're part in the American vision of common unity. You are living it out. In my notes, I have that anger and pain may rally, but they don't sustain. Joanna Macy says that the insights of interrelatedness and compassion sustain us in community and sustain us in ongoing work for justice, participating and contributing to and held in a larger love, that ethic of love. Just this week, think of the groups of community and vision that were here. I can tell you the ones I attended, and Liz Curtis remembered the last phrase in our mission statement, and she organized World Cafe discussion for 20 of us on Tuesday. And then after that, there was a rally outside Reverend Tillis's office. Senator, thank you. It's a good thing I got my glasses. Exactly. No, thank you. Change the identity. We should speak to him about that. That would be good. Yeah, Senator, I'm sure there's some of that going on in him. But yeah, there was a rally. And then we had the Soul Matters group on Wednesday. And then Friday was the postcard writing session. Well, before, now let me say something else. There was a young mother's sense afterwards of how to keep doing this with everything else she is doing. But then in another group, there was another mother reminding us that she is changing the world by what she is modeling for her children and for her grandchildren. She was counting and acting with her power and her love in her sphere of influence. Each of us, where the accent is on each, and then changes to also accent us, each of us. Before we did the World Cafe piece, Liz Curtis, because we were going to sit around in our table and talk about kindness, and there were different questions where we addressed kindness, and then we moved on to the next table to say what was kindness, and then to say how would we live out kindness, and what difference does that make in our lives, and how are we better for it? But Liz had us think about our emotions that we were bringing into the day and write it on a card. And this is my card. Our emotions, mad, sad, glad, scared, that kind of thing. I wrote, I am scared for the people and beings and things I love and care about. And I am angry at those who would threaten them. But mostly I'm scared because I love and because I care. And I put it in my pocket. Our identities are real and important. Identified lives and experiences matter. Somehow we must honor and hold them in their diversity. They are also part of something larger, a love in which we, as we participate and contribute, we each become a part of. We belong. We be our longing and become us together. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Hendersonville, a community where mermaids stand, in body or in spirit, and tug on your pants legs, and then step out into the world to make it a better, more inclusive place. Each of us, each for us. Thank you.